Welcome to Wabanaki Windows. I'm your host, Donna Loring. Our topic today is federally recognized versus state recognized tribes and the repercussions of creating fake tribes. My guests are Professor Hal Prince, emeritus at Kansas State University, Professor Darren Ranko, member of the Penobscot Nation, Professor of Anthropology and Chair of the Native American Studies at the University of Maine. Molly Mbomsawin is an Abenaki and citizen of the Odinak Nation. She is an internationally renowned musician, recently nominated for a Grammy for her work in the film Sugarcane. Molly is also a social justice activist who is working to bring to light issues that stem from the state recognition of four tribes in Vermont. This is a highly controversial issue, but one I think is important to discuss. So I want to start out with the historic background of the Abenaki in the area we now call Vermont. So Harold, will you start us out?
Good morning, Donna, Darren, and Molly. It's a privilege to be back on your show. And I wish that someone was on this panel who you had about 3 years ago, named Colin Calloway. Colin Calloway is the author of a book called The Western Abenaki of Vermont, 1600 to 1800. And he's probably the best informed historically in terms of the indigenous presence in that part of New England. When we mention Vermont, it's the same problem as when we talk about places like Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Rhode Island. These are superimposed boundaries on indigenous nations. So when we talk about the history of indigenous peoples, these lines that we now take for granted, namely the boundary between Quebec and Vermont, for example, or the boundary between New Brunswick and Maine, but also between Vermont and New Hampshire and Maine, all these lines were drawn as a result largely of colonial British and French presence. And in Maine, of course, we had the boundary dispute that took about half a century before that was resolved in 1842 with the Webster-Ashburton Treaty. And that came in on the heels of the so-called Aroostook War, the Bloodless Aroostook War. And I say this because to understand the complexity of indigenous peoples in this part of the world, much more so than the complexity of the Northern Plains, for example, is that you've had a massive disruptive force that began in the late 1500s on the lives of indigenous peoples that led to the extermination, sometimes campaigns of deliberate genocide, but certainly of displacement, violent displacement. And that means you had a lot of refugee communities. So when you look at the landscape of Wabanakia, the territory of the Wabanaki peoples in the year, let's say, 1600, as opposed to 1700 or 1800 or 1900, you have to have a very dynamic map in mind in order to get an understanding, not only in terms of population movement, but also of remnant groups that were survivors of groups that have become largely exterminated as entities. So here we have in New England groups such as where Molly traces her ancestry to, which is the Kennebec Abenaki. The Kennebec Abenaki as a tribe ceased to exist as a functioning unit before the American Revolutionary War. I will not get into the details, but it's a very complicated narrative. Some of the survivors from the Kennebec migrated under duress into the protection of French Canada in Quebec. There were so-called mission villages. And in the case of the Abenaki, both of the Kennebec, but also the Androscoggin and the Saco, and down south, many of them left to what was then called Bécancour, which is the ancestral community, the Wawenoc or Walenoc. And others moved much farther southwest towards St. Francis, that has become known as Odinak. And so there were other groups. One of them were the Missisquoi Abenaki, at the northern end of Lake Champlain. So just to add to a little bit of complexity, that territory there, just in the western end of Vermont, in the period that we're talking about before the colonial era ended, that was actually an area that was inhabited by Mahican Indians. And the Mahican were at war with the Mohawk, their western neighbors, on the other side of the Hudson River. A group of those Mahican who spoke an Algonquian language as opposed to the Mohawk migrated at one point, again under pressure, all the way to the Kennebec River Valley. They ended up at a village called Amasukonti on the Sandy River. They were there for a number of years. We're not entirely clear. Had a fortified village where also a lot of the refugees from the Saco and Roscoggin and Kennebec also went there. Anyway, long, long story short, the Kennebec River was the victim, indigenous peoples at the Kennebec River were the victims of a genocidal campaign, a series of them, and there was a dispersal, you could call it a diaspora. And in that diaspora, what happened in terms of places like Vermont, you have indigenous presence. Groups that existed there are no longer recognized as entities today. The Sokoki is a good example of that. There's also the Kowasuk, for example, and the Missisquoi groups that were more fluid in terms of their presence. And then I mentioned the Mahican. So what happened is that the what we now call the Western Abenaki is a conglomerate of people that comprises earlier entities that have merged, disappeared, vanished. The problem in Vermont is that there's a direct line being drawn between people today who live there and the remains or the mentionings or the records, the archaeological records and so forth, between the populations who were there in the 1600s and 1700s and before, way before, thousands of years before. So the template that I used the term before is extraordinarily complicated and very dynamic, and to trace who is who and is entitled to what is very fluid. And I will leave it at that because I've now hit on a lot of things that pertains to Mali's ancestors.
Hey, Molly, go ahead.
Yeah. You know, Colin is a pretty good resource. I think the Odinak Abenaki are probably a better resource on our history too. So I think that to zoom out a little bit, you know, on the early 1600s, right, you have the first sort of English folks trafficking Abenaki people off of the coast of Maine, like Allen Island, right? What's the other one? Monhegan Island, right? The first five Abenaki and Wawanak people are stolen from the shores and taken to Europe and taken to the Caribbean. And, you know, 10 years later, you have the Great Dying, right? When the diseases from Europe come and wipe out huge percentiles of Wabanaki people, especially in the sort of western part of the territory, and the fall of Bashevis, right, in 1619. And so all of Wabanaki territory is in total chaos in terms of our population, our leadership structure, right? And we're starting to notice that we're being contacted from both the north and the French coming down the St. Lawrence, and from the eastern seaboard in the area that is now called Vermont. Our traditional sort of hunting territories, our traditional canoe routes lead up to the St. Lawrence Valley from Lake Champlain, from the Connecticut River, right? And so that was a common route that the people would travel, the Sokokis in particular, in that further west territory. And by the 1660s, you get the first group of Sokoki people resettling permanently at Odinak and the other missions up there. You start to see in the rolls at these Catholic missions that the Jesuits have established, you'll get, you know, 100 Abenakis unspecified, which is Wabanakis, just the way that the French were writing it. Wabanaki is unspecified, coming from Kennebec River or coming from Vermont, various places in Vermont. And you had other kinds of refugees or travelers coming through and staying for the winter and then going back to their traditional territories. And at Odenak, we have a plaque to those first ancestors that we know settled there in 1660. And it says, here founded by the Sakokis and Abenakis in the year 1660. And this is a plaque that we erected in 1960, marking the 300 years memory. By the 1670s, with the onset of war, the Deerfield Raid, and then the King Philip's War, more and more people were moving north. And this is, I guess, sort of review, because I know that I ended the last session with this history, but throughout the King Philip's War, it became less and less safe for our people to be in our homelands in the western part of Wabanaki territory, with scout bounties, with stories like Hannah Dustin, right? That really helped to elevate the thirst for Indian scalps from the settlers. And by the turn of the 18th century, 1700, that war was moving further east. So over those 150 years of warfare, you get more and more people relocating to Odenak and Wolanak, coming back down to do treaty negotiations for a while, coming back down to do raids on settlements and defend our traditional territory. And those sort of movements from south to north and then north back to south and the great loop around the territory never ended. And in fact, I find myself making that loop all the time, dizzyingly often. So for reasons of commerce, for reasons of defending ancestral territory and our environment, for reasons of sustaining ourselves with, hunting, we have always traveled those routes. However, formally, we stopped having an organized tribal presence in Vermont by the year 1800. And the American Revolution had a lot to do with that. Darren?
Did you?
Wow. Thank you, Molly and Harold and Donna. Great to be joining you all again. I don't think I have a lot to add there. I would just say that the context of how in that complicated history of sort of English and French, settler kind of claims to places that later become, the states of Vermont or New Hampshire, or, really the Connecticut River itself, I think becomes this really important site for Native people. It's kind of the lifeblood. It's the largest river system in what is now called New England. The Penobscot is the second largest. But that idea that this river connects people, I think, is really important. And during the intensification, especially of English colonial claims and warfare, that was detailed there in the 18th century, in particular, it also becomes an important site. And I think this idea that you could use the Connecticut River and its tributaries as sort of easy travel. I mean, Molly probably drives up 91. Or which is actually a parallel interstate to the Connecticut River, all the way down to Connecticut. Although depending on where she's coming from, she might go 89 if she's coming from over in Maine. Anyway, it's just sort of a highway thing. But I think I just want to kind of define that place, because I think that the idea of ease of travel and then locating across the territory, the Connecticut River, I think just in its tributaries play a huge role, because it's like, in a birch bark canoe, Without dams, it's a pretty important, and fast-moving place for people to travel down from Canada, up from the southern parts of New England. So it's to me that just weighs really heavily on the context. I would also say too, like the and again, I wish Colin was here to speak to this piece in particular, is that the Abenaki during the Revolutionary War, and who they fought for and with, I think is an important thing to consider, as we consider, some of the arguments made of like where did they go, and I think that time frame, I would triple down on what Molly said, like that it is post the Revolutionary War that many of the folks who had Abenaki folks who had been maintained, primary residence in their territory in what is now Vermont, ultimately, move from there. But it is not long after the Revolutionary War. So I think that timing, I think, plays in a big way to us trying to find, where did they go and why. And I think, that's, I'm hoping we'll talk more about that. But I think I just want to sort of say, like, the revolution itself, I think, is a really important part of that. So I'd love to have, Harold and Molly talk about that.
A quick comment about where did they go, but Molly already indicated earlier it's not the going but also the returning and on a repeated basis. And to give you an idea of, and most of your audience will be perhaps surprised by that, but here in the Kennebec, if you think about the 1660s, so that's a long, long time before the Revolutionary War, and it's even before what I call the First Anglo-Wabanaki War, the King Philip War in the colonial records. Even before the First Anglo-Wabanaki War, the major chief here on the lower Kennebec, Rawandugan, nicknamed by the English Chief Robin Hood, who was a shaman chief, he was raiding all the way up to the Connecticut River in a war against the Mohawk. The Mohawk themselves, also in the 1660s, came all the way down the Penobscot River toward Pentagouet. So if you think about where now is Castine, there were Mohawk Indians, a raiding party was out there, and had many of the Kennebec Abenaki had fled into the Penobscot River Valley, where they had relatives. So there was a close relationship between the Kennebec and the Penobscot, but so were close relationships that we now know less about, which is the Androscoggin, and all the other rivers that Darren and Molly referenced earlier. So my point is that the travel routes, and Darren was just mentioning Molly driving all these highways, but you have to understand the river system and the portage routes in order to understand the mobility. And much of that was not noticed by Europeans on the coast. So you had an incredible dynamic going on in the hinterland when the seacoast became too dangerous for most Wabanaki to be, in particular in times of war. But there's a massive number of movements going on. And back to Donna, if you think about Donna's ancestor, Governor Neptune, as well as many other Penobscot, would make repeatedly trips all the way to near Montreal to Kahnawake, which is the Mohawk village. So, and they didn't just go there with stops where ready food was there already there. They needed to hunt for survival. They established camps, and so these trips might take weeks before they got there and weeks before they got back. So it was an incredible network of relationships, of mobility, activity, migration back, migration forth, merging, splitting, and so forth and so forth. So the confusing situation for Vermont is precisely that. It's very confusing that even for an expert like Colin Calloway, who wrote the book that I mentioned earlier, even for him, there are question marks about what really happened there, how to interpret this, where to draw a connection here and there. I referenced that book because I reviewed it at the time very laudably and deservedly so, but it's not the final word. Historians perpetually revisit the past with new questions, new interpretations, and sometimes based on new data.
Okay, so let's fast forward here. So Molly, explain what the situation is now in Vermont. You have some state recognized tribes. Tell us about that situation.
Yeah, well, I think that in the fact of this imposed border through our territory and the language barrier that that also sort of creates in the research and the histories has provided some gaps that have been taken advantage of. I think that's really what we're coming up against here. And, you know, our history is very well kept by the French. Our history is, you know, at least accessible in English, but with lots of gaps, right? And researchers have often not sort of cross-referenced, either because they couldn't or didn't think to or whatever. Meanwhile, people have been traveling across this border as if it didn't exist, you know, for a long time. And in as Abenaki presence sort of ceased to be regular in that part of our homeland in the 1800s, there were all of these migrations, especially in the mid and late 1800s, of French Canadians coming down to work in Vermont. That produced a large working class population of French Canadians who were discriminated against for their origin, who kept, you know, tightly in family groups, you know, who worked similar kinds of jobs to Indians, actually, if there were Indians, or to other kinds of folks who were sort of not invited into the like proud white Vermont stock status. And those groups, based on the genealogical data that is kept and that is public record, ended up in the 1970s and 60s to start to identify as Indian, but were very clearly documented as having been French Canadian over time since their arrival in that period. In the 1970s, we start to get these groups forming in Missisquoi area, Swanton, Vermont area, claiming to be Indians.
Karen?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we've referenced this a couple of times. I mean, there's this, in 2010, the state of Vermont passes a law which sets up a commission to recognize tribal groups in to the extent that we call that being state recognized or recognized by the state. You know, I think that means a lot of different things in a lot of different kind of contexts, right? Because, you know, Donna, we were quote unquote state recognized as tribes until the 1970s. But I think that has a different history and formulation, and so there's just saying state recognized, I think it has a really specific thing. This is an act of the Vermont legislature setting up a commission made up a lot of the same people who were being who were making claims were on this commission, and they were making decisions around how what is considered to be a tribe, and they eventually in the state of Vermont recognized four different groups. And I think, you know, the primary issue, if I could set it up, is that, you know, Molly's relations and what I would consider our cousins as Penobscots, that we don't we don't see them as kin. There's no evidence that they are our kin by and large, although I think there is a small number of folks who are in these four tribes of various things that do have kin relations or kin ties with Abenaki, the Abenaki folks in Canada. And I think, this idea that there is this claim out there, mostly by non-Indigenous people, to Abenaki identity is the controversy. One thing I want to pick up on too, and just in sort of the as people fill in the gaps around the quote unquote controversy, is this idea of gaps or cleavages or what you would call are kind of issues that are being kind of brought in various indirect ways that make this more complicated than sometimes it appears to be from the outside. One of those is the idea of evidence. What is evidence in terms of being an Indigenous person in identity? One thing that comes up a lot in this sort of back and forth around that is the use of oral history or family history as a form of evidence, wherein, quite clearly, many Indigenous advocates in things like repatriation or even claims to rights or treaty rights, we want to include oral histories, right? We want to include our traditional stories and our framings around how those things work. And I think people who have stories of families claiming certain kinds of identities here, which is part of a move, a colonial move too, to claim Indigenous identities, they use that, right? So people who would otherwise advocate for the use of oral history are like, no, you're not, there's this back and forth, like when, where, and how is that appropriate? So I think that's one of those sort of places of exploitation. And then another one that I wanted to just raise up was just how much we can or should trust colonial sources. So it's related to that one, which is to say, clearly, as Indigenous people, we don't just trust the colonial sources here and telling us who we are or what our histories are. And I think the idea that a lot of times we're looking in terms of identity or census records or whatever, we're looking for claims of identity through colonial sources is again one of those places that can be exploited for saying, like, I thought you were saying don't trust the colonial sources. Sure, the colonial sources say I'm French, Canadian, or whatever, but I want it to be my oral history says something else. And so I think this also complicates it. And I think Molly wants to, but I guess I just wanted to tease out some of those ideas of like what's making it complicated or what gaps are being exploited in terms of what Molly just said.
Molly, do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, just briefly. I thank you for bringing that up, Darren, this like evidence question, because I do think that there are like competing value systems, several actually in this situation, right? There's like the like Western sort of science data, records thing. There's like this like imaginary native value system of history and how we keep it, which is being sort of like reflected onto us by Pretendians. And then there's how native like communities actually keep history, right? And it's funny, Chief Obomsawin, and in one of the conferences that we had with where these groups in Vermont were present and many other spectators, Chief Obomsawin said, we rely really heavily actually on the documents that have been kept by the church in our own communities and in local sort of hi history places by non-natives, because of course, people have tried to erase us, right? Settlers have tried to erase us, but they keep their own histories, and so we have to triangulate between our, yes, of course, our family histories, our oral histories, our continued knowledge over time, that is, i.e., I go to my family and I say, am I still your family? And they say, yes, right? The churches that marked every baptism as they were trying to convert the entire nation to Catholicism or Protestantism, and the treaties where we show up, even if you talk to a historic preservation officer, right? All the ones that I know are constantly scouring, flea markets, newspapers, right? Any mention of us is useful because it helps us to paint a broader picture that, correct, like was not kept in like a full way by one source, right? But that's, I think, the like pluralism of historical knowledge sources is how we are certain of ourselves.
May I add to that quickly? Because I did this work for a decade for the Mi'kmaq in northern Maine, but as a anthropologist employed by the tribe, I started that as a co-director with Bunny of the Association of Rustic Indians as director of research and development, and then became the staff anthropologist for the Mi'kmaq, Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaq, now known as the Mi'kmaq Nation. And so indeed, just as both Darren and Molly just articulated, there was a plethora of sources. Ironically, one of the sources that I used were jail records. It was a painful source, but because I knew the story behind that, but I also realized that that's where it was a treasure source, and the pauper records in town. The pauper records were very important as well, but essentially, without the community themselves being involved, it would have been impossible for me to really do that work in terms of creating a narrative that would sustain the claim by the Mi'kmaq community in northern Maine for a state, or sorry, for federal recognition at the time. And so that was based on very much on the families who knew, yes, so and so is a Mi'kmaq. So I had one case of a wonderful Mi'kmaq woman, a basket maker. And we had no historical records for her to verify that she would qualify for membership. But all the evidence from the family and the neighbors who knew her all testified, and my own interrogation, if you will, of her to make sure it was all bona fide and I could defend it if I were in a court case as an expert witness, why she was in and why she was not in. And so back to the groups in Vermont. There's something called, and it's a very flawed process, but nevertheless, it's a process, it's called the Federal Acknowledgement Petition. So, in other words, there's a series of criteria that the federal government has established to basically sort out all these different claims by different groups of Indian status that they wanted the recognition by the federal government, or in this case, state government, as a step toward federal recognition, perhaps. That a group would have to follow a procedure. Now, I mentioned that that procedure is flawed, and I can't get into it, it's too detailed, but it's important to know that Vermont is not unique in terms of not having federally recognized tribes. There are 12 of them, 12 states in the United States where there are no federally recognized tribes at all, and all of them are east of the Mississippi. And that is not surprising, but just to give you a list, so no federally recognized tribes in New Hampshire, not in Vermont, not in New Jersey, not in Delaware, not in Pennsylvania, not in Ohio, not in Kentucky, not in West Virginia, not in Tennessee, not in Missouri, not in Georgia, not in Arkansas, and not in Illinois. So it's a very interesting case when you look at the state situation of Vermont, that if you look at it in the broader picture of Eastern North America, it's not unusual at all to see groups that are trying to get recognition. I did not mention, and I will spare you the list, of the staggering number of groups, both in the entire United States, all the way from the Atlantic to the Pacific, who claim Indian status, but are not having a legitimate recognition of that they are so, other than by themselves. And so, again, the situation of Vermont that seems to be unique because it's in the news. It's not unique at all. It's extraordinarily common for a lot of groups who have formed themselves, sometimes based on legitimate reasons. There's a group of Yaqui in the New Mexico, Mexico area, Arizona area, the Pascua Band. Everybody knows they're Yaqui, but in a very controversial situation, they are politically very sensitive. And other groups are hobby Indians, what used to be called hobby Indians. They are very good in crafts, they're good in dances, they do the powwows, they do the beadwork. In academia, there's a lot of these hobby Indians that have found their way of being recognized as Indians, indigenous people, who have got promotions in academia, positions in academia. And Dartmouth, I believe, has one of them. I will not mention names because I don't want to have any litigation against Donna as a host.
Thank you. Very thoughtful, Harold. Made me lose my train of thought here. So how does the formation of these tribes, say these tribes that are state recognized without a lot of legal historic background or whatever, how does that affect the already federally recognized tribes or tribes that sort of meet all of the criteria for the historic criteria for themselves and also for state, for federal? How does the federally recognized tribes, how are they affected by these state recognized tribes?
We call them self-identified Abenaki in
Thank you.
Shorthand, because we were like, we can't really call them tribes. They're not tribes. But I mean, I would say, I think that a lot can be learned from just looking at their processes, the criteria that they sort of set for themselves in the review boards, right? And because they kind of explain their own intentions. I have from a piece of their petition for acknowledgement, they say many contemporary Abenaki families continue to produce traditional crafts and intend to continue to pass on these indigenous traditions to younger generations. In order to create and sell Abenaki crafts, that may be labeled as Indian or Native American produced, the Abenaki must be recognized by the state of Vermont. So commerce was like always a goal there, to be able to make these things, that I think in the last session, I even mentioned like some of my ancestors who went down to teach at Boy Scout camps probably taught them how to make, right? So that's one thing. I'll let others speak to it as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of ongoing harms, right? I mean, how do claims by indigenous people, non-indigenous people, if you know, claims by non-indigenous people to indigenous identity, how do they harm indigenous people? I think is, you know, I think a lot of controversies have come up, right, where people have, you know, extending the commerce idea, right, which is, you know, forms of authenticity, which I referenced in the last time. You know, there's at the end of the 19th century, there's this claims by there's a campaign of Abenaki from Canada, who traveled down to the resort Grand Resort hotels in northern New Hampshire and Vermont. This is in a piece by Ruth Phillips, where you know, they post this warning to the folks who are visiting these resort hotels, saying, "Don't buy these crafts from these people because they're French Canadians pretending to be Indian." And this isn't like a new thing. So this is from like the 1890s, right? So that idea of stealing economic opportunity is sort of in the 21st century, right? We've seen so many of these cases of folks claiming identities, getting positions or awards or, you know, things that are, you know, kind of sought, you know, meant to go to indigenous people and sort of what that does. But I think, you know, the ongoing harms in terms of the legacies of like really trying to, what I would say is obfuscate the more complicated notions. And I really appreciate, Molly, you definitely step through the kind of opening that I was trying to create with like forms of evidence. Like, you know, I think those of us who, you know, believe in the truth or the idea of the truth and that evidence matters, and that there is an ongoing that has existed. Part of settler colonialism is a occupation and erasure, and so occupation of identity and therefore erasing actual indigenous identities is a critical part of colonialism. And then, I found as I was just sort of thinking about this, and how does this go down in like contemporary histories or representation of histories of various indigenous people? About 2 years ago, Odinak Chief Rick Obomsawin wrote a letter to the Ethan Allen Homestead Museum in Burlington, and so Molly and Harold are probably aware of this, but I also thought that it was interesting because this is what happens in the kind of the public debates around things is with self-identified Abenaki people in Vermont often is that there was a picture from the 1890s of an Odinak Abenaki family. Who was it? Is the Panadis, yeah, family. And so they'll say like, here's a picture of Abenakis in Vermont, right? Like, and they'll be like, look, so that means there's Aben, but then you actually know this family, then you can be like, oh, they actually are they're they call their permanent home Odinak, right? They don't see themselves as Vermont Abenaki. And I've seen this, and I had an email exchange with the scholar Christopher Roy just this past week, and we were kind of talking about it, and he's done a lot to kind of dig down into the depths of kind of what happens in these sort of public disagreements or debates around the identity, is that they'll use the presence of folks who are from Odinak or whose families are centered at Odinak and take a picture of them in Vermont at a particular moment in time doing any number of economic or cultural kinds of things. And then that'll be the evidence, right, of, well, they're here. And then therefore, there must be a bunch of other families, that kind of thing. Not giving the broader context of where that family calls home and who recognizes them. And I think, this is done, I think, repeatedly where it just gets complicated. Anyway, Molly, I'll just hand it back to you. But it's striking because this exhibit meant that that Chief Obomsawin wrote a letter saying like, saying these are Vermont's, Abenaki, and then the exhibit said something about like Abenaki, Vermont's first people, of course, which is a claim that is so weird in and of itself. That it this letter he wrote was just basically saying, you can't, it was like a cease and desist letter. Don't use artifacts that pertain to us without our consent, to represent this idea of an ongoing kind of recognition or Abenaki presence in Vermont in a way that's just misleading. And it kind of leads to then these kind of opportunities that, anyway.
I think that that story is so important because not only did Rick write that letter, but there was a delegation from Odinak that came down to protest in person, including the direct descendants of the Panadis family that's in the photo. And they had a confrontation at the Ethan Allen Homestead Museum with the members of the self-identified Abenaki group that were there, who those members were claiming to be related to the people in the photo, when we have all of their genealogies, we know it's categorically untrue. They actually had the genealogy, like, we brought the genealogies with us to be like, listen, like, this is where your grandparents come from. And the Panadas descendants were like, this is my grandfather. And it was like so absurd to have to argue about that in real life in front of this photo.
Harold.
Back to your question, Donna, about to what degree do these movements hurt the federally recognized tribes? And Molly was earlier referencing commerce, but it's not just commerce, it's also allocations from the budget in the federal government that goes to Indian country. And Indian country is growing. There's no genocidal campaigns going on. The health situation is still precarious on many tribal reservations, but still the average life expectancy is increasing. And so what you get is a population growth and a budget that is not keeping track with that population growth. And that means the per capita payout that is available in terms of resources is going to get smaller proportionally. And so that is rarely brought up, but it is a factor. And I believe that in North Carolina, the resistance by the federally recognized Eastern Band of Cherokee against the recognition of the Lumbee is in part motivated by that concern. That is a huge group of state-recognized Lumbee from the so-called Lumber River area, which is what gave their name after World War II, is contested as being Cherokee by the Eastern Band of Cherokee. And we have many other examples of that. And again, I should also emphasize, for myself at least, I'm not an expert on Vermont, so I cannot make a statement that they have no good argument or bad argument. My expertise limits itself only to questioning, as any scholar does, and as Christopher Roy, who is a scholar and had thought he was an Abenaki, but realized he couldn't come up with the evidence and basically disclaimed Abenaki identity in Vermont. But we all try to do right by history in terms of finding out what is truth, and that's extraordinarily elusive and difficult. And so, and again, sitting here in Maine, far away from Vermont, I don't have the expertise at all that Molly has, or even Darren has, who lived in Vermont himself. But I think it's important for all of us to be careful not to pass judgment without having at our fingertips all the particular data.
Molly?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, in the case of Vermont, the data has been very well demonstrated, and the conclusion of the 2002 Vermont Attorney General's report, which investigated thoroughly the claims and the history, right, was that the lack of proof of Abenaki heritage pervades the petitioner's submission. And based off of that, the Bureau of Indian Affairs Federal Recognition review also concluded 8% of the petitioners, 1,171, oh, sorry, 8 of the petitioners, 1,171 full members, which is less than 1%, demonstrated descent from an Indian ancestor. And so they did not receive recognition. But I think it's important, you know, we keep coming back to like commerce and resources, but I think it's we sort of risk making it seem like our communities are just like after money, you know, that we just exist to receive free resources, because that's obviously like a racist trope against us. And so I just wanted to like zoom out for a second on why we expect resources and why we expect our trade agreements from, you know, the 17th and 1800s and 1900s to be respected, right? Because settlers came here, decided to form communities, decided that they wanted to have their own governments, and we were already here. We treated with them. We said, okay, maybe you can stay given this, 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 and this, and you have to uphold these responsibilities to us over time, right? And like that's where sovereignty is the most important thing to continue to come back to. You know, it's not about like we want our handout. It's like y'all blocked our rivers, y'all occupied our most precious territories, y'all, you know, murdered us by decree, and you know, we have come to a peace agreement with you. and this is what it takes to uphold it, right? And so it's, I don't know, I want to circle back to that as regularly as possible, that these new groups being invented chips away at this nation to nation relationship that we have upheld over time.
Darren.
And I think I'm so stuck on this idea of evidence, proving identity and what that means, and the so much of our identities as Indigenous people are as much about who claims you, not what you claim. There's these all these things, but I think specifically in terms of Wabanaki diplomacy and the 19th century, for example, we have as you all know, right? The leadership, even when we were, in what is now Maine, even when we were forced into a form of democracy, in terms of electing leadership as opposed to our traditional hereditary leadership, the legitimacy of our leadership came as much from recognition, even from within, but from outside, right? We had chiefs from the other, leaderships from the other communities at our installation. So, I mean, this is happening, continuously throughout the 19th century, in Maine, and at places like Odinak and Wallanak, where they're the other Wabanaki leaders are visiting for installations of chief. I don't have the exact records, but I've seen enough of the evidence to know that this was happening in these places, but not in Vermont or New Hampshire. And I think, the retort by the groups there in Vermont and New Hampshire is that they were sort of hiding or hiding in plain sight, and it just it it it's just hard to kind of imagine when they're, the evidence of that is often, like I said, these pictures of people who we know are from groups, from places like Odinak, from these communities. And I think, we had a similar kind of thing, Donna, here with the idea of tribes. Although it's a little bit different, because I think if we think about the idea of, say a potential Maliseet tribe, on at Kineo or around Moosehead Lake or whatever, I think it begs this other question, which is about what is a tribe, or what is a community? Because, I would say many of the people of the ancestors, let's say they are, Indigenous, but then we recognize them as their source communities as being at Tobik or at Penobscot or whatever. They just happen to be living in the 19th century at this place, or they make, economic choices to be in that place, and sort of how we even understand that. So I think it asks more complicated questions about what even is a tribe, and I think to me that's, we have to go to the current, our diplomacy demands that we then go to, because of the Confederacy and our histories of relations with one another, that we go to the current tribes to understand, what is a tribe and how do we recognize that? Like I don't, I'm not comfortable, either with the federal government or the state of Vermont. Like, I mean, I think this idea that we would question, colonial sources, I would question even the terms of recognition that colonial governments, including the state of Vermont, use. I think, more powerful to me than the state of Vermont recognizing a group would be the rest of us as Wabanaki, our leadership, our tribes recognizing a group, right? I mean, that would be to me, that's the top evidence. It's kind of like the same kind of thing that Molly was saying. Like, the top evidence is like, it's in the community. We use both written and oral sources, and we triangulate. And this is sort of a part of sort of the nature of our work in community. And I think that's what I would say to, like, and my biggest sort of concern, and I lived, on the border of New Hampshire and Vermont for a number of years, like, just the how it was, it's so different, folks from Odinak, Wolanak, and then the folks from the self-proclaimed Abenaki groups in New Hampshire, Vermont, just how different my interactions are with them. Like, just how kin-oriented one interaction is, and how sort of transactional and the other set of interactions are, in terms of we can trace to common stories or histories with folks from Roanoke or Wolanoke, and I find that very challenging in the case of the self-proclaimed folks in New Hampshire and Vermont. So this is just me speaking, like, what would I consider good evidence? I don't think holding, the state of Vermont standard or the federal government standard, right? These are violations in their own forms, and to be, we should be, if we're suspicious about the colonial records, then you have to be kind of suspicious of the state of Vermont suddenly seeing the light and being like, here, I'll recognize you. So.
Yeah. So there's a question I think people ask, and it some of us might think it's pretty ignorant, but I'm going to ask it, and I'm going to ask Molly to answer it. What does it matter to I'll use the term Canadian Indians, what happens in Vermont?
Oh man.
Hot button.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think first of all, like this conversation about the Kineo group, right, in Maine, your situation is so distinctly different because it's happening in your territory, and all of the Wabanaki tribes in Maine are able to have the conversation. Yeah, maybe we do talk,
No, Molly, I'm asking not from a Penobscot perspective or Maine tribal, but from the general public's perspective.
I guess what I was gonna get to is, like, Vermont won't listen to us about who we are in our own territory, right? That's our land that we have always been in, and so to be told that our knowledge systems and our stance doesn't qualify as worthy to be regarded in our territory because we are now formally located and recognized on the other side of a border that we fought against for hundreds of years and that we don't believe should be there. I mean, it's hugely offensive, but it also prevents us from having any kind of meaningful presence in our homeland, that to protect it, which is our responsibility as Wabanaki people, to protect the land that we are.
But I'd like to thank you for joining us today. I'm your host, Donna Loring. You've been listening to Abenaki Windows. The music for our show is by Rolf Richter, a track called Little Eagles from his CD Dreamwalk. The engineers for our show are Jessica Lockhart and Joel Mann. Tune in again next month for another Abenaki Windows.